From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Media Project is underway, an opportunity for a half hour of commentary, analysis, and maybe if we're lucky, even some insight into the media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, welcoming you to our program. Here next to me in the studio of WAMC is Ira Fussfeld, the longtime publisher of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York.
Mr. Sir. Rex, how are you?
I am well, thank you.
Good to see you. Alan, how are you?
Alan, there he is.
Don't ask. I'll sit in the dark and just feel bad.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Alan is from an undisclosed remote location in the beautiful Berkshire Mountains of Massachusetts, but fortunately, through the miracles of technology, we can hear him. In the studio, Dr. Alan Shartek, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. We have guests right through the glass in the studio here are students from Professor Rich Bader's New Visions class. These are high school seniors. It's a selective, rigorous college-level career exploration program. Every year, are happy to welcome the New Visions Law and Government students. They're based at the Education Department building, right, in Albany. And it's just a remarkable program that is nationally recognized for the opportunity to give academically competitive high school seniors great AP credit.
They're very polite young people because I was just in there talking to them for 10 minutes and they're still there. They didn't get up and leave. So I think that's good.
Very kind. Very kind. All right, so we will launch, and Alan, I hope you feel better as the program goes along, you know.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question. Anytime I'm around you, Rex, I always feel better.
Well, I know that it gets your adrenaline rushing, you know, when we say some things, and so that's bound to be good for your ailing back. How about that? A listener, Jeff, says, one thing I think we need to keep in mind, and he's saying this apropos last week's conversation, is that when reporters show these violent storms, it really does drive home the severity of the storm. And so in future instances, I think we will have an increased evacuation number in people more willing to evacuate earlier due to the images that they brought to the table.
Well, I hope he doesn't mean that he needs to see a reporter standing in harm's way being blown around to understand that the storm is pretty bad. I mean, I'll take my chances on making that judgment based on how badly the wind is blowing the rain across the street and how the trees are being bent over. I just don't want to see reporters put their lives in danger.
I guarantee you, Ira, that it's all TV, as we say. It's all TV. And they know that if they don't do it, the guy on the next channel will do it. So they do it because it's part of the game. The other thing that's happening, I think, Rex and Ira, is that things are getting worse. So you got to give people a little bit of a break. I can't tell you how many hurricanes I lived through on Fire Island, for example. But the fact is that, you know, you live through them and they come and they go. And a lot of people think that what we're going to experience from now on will be what we had. And therefore, I think the visuals become very important.
Let me ask you both a question. The president is getting a lot of heat for the response or lack thereof to what happened in Puerto Rico. But it strikes me that the media coverage, particularly the cable news networks, were not nearly as aggressive with the Puerto Rican storm as they were with these two storms on the mainland. So is there more blame to throw around?
I think the media can take some blame for that as well. There is an explanation that does not excuse it. That is, there are fewer reporters based in Puerto Rico, notwithstanding the great population there. So it was not as easy for reporters to get there to be on hand for the damage to do those live shots that you're talking about standing in the midst of the storm as it was in either Florida or Houston, both major population centers for the U.S. So might be that the media bears some of the responsibility for the slow U.S. response.
Well, let me stick up a little bit for CNN, at least, because I've been constantly watching. I think they've done a pretty good job. I think they've been there. I think they've been covering it. But I also think that something else is happening, which is make good now. I think everybody realizes that to some degree it didn't get the coverage that it deserved. And therefore, I think what's happening, Rex and Ira, is that they're playing a much more aggressive game post-hurricane than they did before.
Well, let me ask you this. Was there responsibility on the media's part for being distracted from that story by such topics as, oh, say, the president tweeting about the NFL? Were we led astray, in effect, by pursuing that story instead of continuing to home in on what was going on in Puerto Rico?
Yeah, but the hurricanes, as they approached the mainland, the previous hurricanes, we, the media, particularly the big media, had people staged before the storms, warning that the storms were coming, didn't see that same coverage. And as a result of all of that coverage, the other things that you're talking about were pushed to the side. That didn't happen with Puerto Rico. I just think that they're late to the party. I'm not suggesting that it's not difficult. As Trump pointed out, Puerto Rico is in the middle of a big ocean and it's an island, so it's not as easy to get to. I don't know that he had just learned that. I mean, there are some people who wonder whether he even knew that Puerto Rico was a U.S. territory. But I think that you're right, Alan. CNN and MSNBC, I don't watch Fox, so I don't know what they're doing, but they've been quite good in recent days. But I just think they were late to the party.
Well, of course, with all due respect, Ira, I just don't agree, because I remember watching as the storm approached. I remember people out there on CNN, and I think it may have not gone to the same degree. But let's talk about for a second what Rex raised with us, which is Trump. Texas and Florida are Republican states, and much more Texas, but Florida is,
yeah,
too.
Florida very narrowly so. The last gubernatorial and presidential races in Florida each have been decided by 1 point or less.
Let's remember, Rex, not to be disrespectful, the way it went in the end. You know, it may have been 1 point, it may not have been. But the fact of the matter is, these are constituent states for the president of the United States. Puerto Rico, if there ever was a Democratic bastion, it's it. Now, that doesn't mean they have full voting rights, but I can tell you they're not represented in Congress by a serving congressman. I think to some degree Trump deserves the blame for this, because I think, you know, he was doing this NFL thing, which of course was a bright light if ever there was one. But I want to put myself in the place of the news directors, people who are at CNN or otherwise, and saying, oh my goodness, what are people going to salute to? Is it going to be the NFL and taking a knee, or is it going to be Puerto Rico and we're going to have to make up our minds which come first?
Right. I think that it's true that you can't ignore, if you're a network producer, a local news director, a newspaper editor, you can't ignore tweets by the president of the United States that call into question the actions of tremendously popular, nationally recognized athletes. I mean, that is genuinely newsworthy when the president picks a fight with the National Football League, right? So you can't ignore that. Is that what you're saying, in effect, that it's not just a shiny object? It is something that has to be covered?
Well, I don't know. I really don't know. I've never quite decided whether Trump's motives are shiny object or not. But I do think that that isn't the criteria that news people use, at least on TV, Rex. They use the thing as, what do our people, what is most likely to make them change the channel? Will they go from us to, for example, to MSNBC, from CNN to MSNBC? I really don't think it has to do with ethics or what's right. I think it has to do with, do we lose people and therefore do we lose advertisers? Mm.
So what you're describing is another example, and I think we've talked about it here on numerous occasions, about the impact of how cable news tackles a subject versus how a newspaper tackles a subject, how the internet even tackles a subject, where you can chew gum and walk at the same time. Once the cable news channel decides that this NFL story, for example, is so important and so compelling that it has to cover it from all of these different angles, it virtually does so at the expense of every other story that's out there. Whereas the newspapers can have the NFL story on the front page to indicate that, yes, there is some importance to it and it gives it prominence, but it also has the hurricane and it also has Russia and it also has whatever else is going on in a particular day. And you, as the reader, as the consumer of news, can choose which you feel you want to read more about or not.
That's a very good point. It is structural to the way television operates. It is sequential. That is, you cover this, and then you cover that, and then you cover that, as opposed to the front page of a newspaper, broadsheet at least, you have four or five stories that a reader can choose from. In television, it tends to be, if it's just television, you actually can only cover one thing at a time. And so if you make a decision as a producer, as an executive producer of a show, or as the network president who may well be making some of these key calls when you've got huge stories competing, you really are deciding that's what we've got to go with. That's the horse we're riding on right now.
I've often used the crazy analogy. David Letterman used to stare at the camera and make a funny face or play with his tie and not say anything. And then finally he'd say, "I'm the only thing on CBS right now." And that was, you either watch me or you change the channel.
It's a terrifying notion. But that's true. It is, you know, you can't ignore the fact that the president issuing, let's call them what they are, racist diatribes against athletes participating in the country's most popular sport, calling into question their patriotism, you cannot dispute that that's newsworthy. But once you decide that you're going to go all in on that, then suddenly what falls away is discussion about the health care legislation that was pending and tax reform and all that.
It's the wall-to-wall coverage that sets the agenda and disproportionately makes a story more important than it is.
Now, that isn't true, though, in today's ecosystem of social media, because if you're consuming news by paying attention to your Twitter feed or to your Facebook, to what's going on there, you are able to pick and choose what you see. It goes by you very quickly. But it is more like a newspaper in that you have an opportunity for many bits and pieces of news that you can choose from.
Broadcast is in the same boat, Alan. Do you sometimes sit in the office when you have the station on in the background and NPR is on and you say, why aren't they mixing it up more? I suspect that's not a best example because NPR, it does mix it up. I don't believe NPR has been wall-to-wall on the NFL or any other story.
Well, no. I mean, I think what happens is that in each case, you have basically what I would call, and you have sort of mentioned already, an editorial dictator. I mean, in the end, Roger Ailes knew what he wanted on Fox, and he said, just tell her to pull up her skirts and cross her legs. He was calling the shots on the visuals and whatever else was going on in that place. I believe that if there's a real crisis, that Rex or Mike from the Times Union will be in a position to make their call. And what that means is the psychology of who Rex and Mike are, what their education is, what their politics are, may have a great deal to do with what we're going to read in the paper, or in the case of a news director, I don't make any of those decisions, but Joe Donahue does at WAMC, and our wonderful young news director Ian Pickus does, and all of those issues return to them.
But let me put you on the spot. I mean, you often accuse the New York Times, for example, of following a pattern based on what the reporters and editors know is the worldview of the publisher.
Weltanschauung.
Yeah, that
says,
was it.
Alan has a PhD,
yeah,
so he says Weltanschauung.
Is it not possible that the people here, even though that your hands are not in getting dirty, that they're going to say, gee, Alan would want it done this way?
Anything is possible. I think that the integrity of the news organization becomes very important. I mean, you know, look, the New York Post compared to POST, compared to the Times Union of Albany, New York, did different decisions. The Times Union is a very respectable newspaper, and sometimes they risk being boring compared to the New York Post.
It's true.
You know, because they they may have a different philosophy about selling papers. They may have a different parent organization like the Hearst's, which have different values. But they also have individuals who are making the call. And yes, I think that somebody at WAMC may be thinking, should we do this or not, you know, based on the ethics or the worldview of the radio station. But I doubt very much anybody has ever said, we're not going to play this story because Alan or won't like it.
You know, the complaint from the populist right that I've heard often on AM talk radio is that we in the, let's call it the establishment media, in effect, we are too prone to select stories from our background as with education and cultural opportunities that have not been afforded to the vast reaches of the country. I'm trying to put this gently, that we are basically elitist in our news selections. And I've heard that there's a guy on talk radio in our community in the greater capital region whose background is at the New York POST, as you say, Alan, who really has viciously attacked me personally over the last couple of weeks for story selections, basically saying that it just all reflects the Times Union reflects my elitist point of view. I don't think so. If he knew how hard it was for me to get a story in the paper when I want something, you know, because we are reporter-driven newsroom. Did you ever have that experience?
I tell people who ask me now that I'm retired what it was like, and I said, I wish I'd have a chance to run a newspaper someday.
Yeah.
I was publisher for 25 years, but I wish I had a chance to run one. The reporters and the editors hold sway more often than not.
Yeah, our sensibility is that good stories tend to arise more often from reporters' notebooks than from editors' desktops. I've said that very often, and I really believe that. But that does sometimes get frustrating to an editor who thinks, I do wish a reporter would pay attention when
I
suggest
a
story.
I mean, I believe that most publications, and we can't, as we've said here before, the Post is an outlier. It's a tabloid. It's got its own agenda. Most newspapers try to be fair. They try to be as accurate and to try to get to the truth. And the decisions that they make as to what is going to be in the publication and how much space is going to be afforded to it is based on the experience of the editors, who have a feel for what is and isn't important, and also have a feel for what is or isn't going to be of interest to their readership.
Yeah, very true. And actually, I'll tell you in just a minute who is, I think, calling the shots. This is, by the way, if you're just joining us, the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Dr. Alan Shartok, Ira Fussfeld, and Rex Smith here from Albany, New York. And if you would like to have your thoughts considered here, send us email, media@wamc.org. That's how this program began, with a note from our listener, Jeff. I don't know where Jeff is from. Here's who's actually calling the shots. Jimmy Kimmel. You know, you could make a significant argument that the Republican effort to replace Barack Obama's signature health care bill, the American Health Care Act, was derailed by the opposition of Jimmy Kimmel, who really went on the offensive, slamming both the bill that was being considered in May. This was after his son was born with a heart condition that required emergency heart surgery. And he stepped up emotionally, saying, "This is why we need to have great healthcare legislation in this country, and it's why it would be criminal to repeal legislation that provided healthcare coverage for some 40 million Americans."
Well, he certainly put a face on the issue. But to your point about how the impact that he had, it also demonstrates how you can be a late-night talk show host and have as much, if not more, impact than do the quote-unquote elitist op-ed reporters or commentators on TV.
Yeah. These guys are entertainers, but they have found that this is, through their humor, they're having a great impact. I mean, Stephen Colbert, when he turned on CBS to more political commentary, which was his, you know, that was his trademark anyway from his previous show, and then Seth Meyers and NBC, and now Jimmy Kimmel and ABC, these people each reach millions of people a night with shows that are not produced by the news division. These are purely entertainment shows, but by putting a political touch on them, they're really having an impact on public
And it's not new. I mean, they used to say that the politicians would quake in fear that they'd be part of a Johnny Carson monologue.
You know, I've always watched when people write to me or react to when people write to me and they say, "I'm never going to listen to you again. I'm an important part of your audience, and you would have many more people listening if you were more solicitous of my views and weren't so center-left," they often accuse us of being. But my answer to that is, we're doing pretty well. We have record numbers of people listening to us. And what in the world are you talking about? In other words, if we have to be so pedestrian that we have to be boring, then it ain't worth doing. We're better to be true to ourselves. And if people want to call us names, they have to call us names.
Yeah. And, you know, to the point of your news coverage affecting your audience, here's just an interesting tidbit on the highway of media consumption. The Trump bump, as it's been called, continues for news organizations that are covering this administration thoroughly. The case in point, the Washington Post, which doesn't release a lot of numbers because it's privately held, like my company. But this is the fact. A million paid digital subscribers, in addition to their print ones. Now, this is, of course, far behind the New York Times, which has 3 million, I believe.
I think it was 2.3
million digital only. But the growth of digital subscriptions in an era when the few players on the national media stage that exist, the Times, the Post, USA Today, and the Wall Street Journal, are really our only national newspapers. When they are really focusing on the Trump administration, you can't ignore the fact that there's a great appetite for this reporting that's being done.
And the president of NPR is constantly telling us how much better NPR, he and NPR, are doing. But let me tell you, WAMC, from where we're broadcasting right now, has had two of the most remarkable one-day fund drives in history, all attributable to Donald Trump, no question about it. So there's this sort of push-pull thing. On the one hand, the media may be doing better because of Trump. On the other hand, the people who are running the media often despise them.
Well, the bigger problem, the longer-term problem, is that the media is split in so many different ways, and people are finding the media organization or organizations that broadcast or write about things in a manner with which they agree, without taking into effect that there is another side or hearing the other side. And for those of us who try to be as close as we can down the middle, that's not good enough for either side because we're not on their side. And this is a problem that I'm not smart enough to know how this is going to sort itself out. But certainly Trump has drilled the concept of fake news in so that when he does something that could be negative, such as his response to the Puerto Rico disaster, when he says how good he's doing and others report otherwise, he will then say, though, that's fake news. You can't believe it. And there are people who will not believe it. And that kind of go to your own corner circumstance is terribly difficult to deal with. And I think going to be very detrimental, is already being detrimental to the country.
There'll be people who are listening right now who are going to say, when Ira says we try to play it right down the middle, they'll be saying Bushu. That's not true.
Well, exactly, but that proves my point.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't, because it's conceivable that you're right, that your editorial policy in your newspaper is correct, but that it's not down the middle. I mean, you know, what do you want to do? Be down the middle with Donald Trump?
Well, that's an interesting point, because the critics on the other side are criticizing the media, for example, for not calling racism racism, for saying that we're dancing around the word racist in covering some of the president's tweets. The media will use terms like racially charged, racially loaded, racially divisive. And so the question is, are you being clear in your coverage, or are you actually saying, no, we're being more
fair.
Cautious, fair.
Being fair.
You're being fair.
But being fair is a loaded term, because it ain't fair when Donald Trump tries to take 23 million people off the healthcare rolls. I mean, what are you going to do? Say, oh, well, some people say that's okay, and some people say it's not okay. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, I think, by the way, you're right. I think that the terms like racist are, you might call them conclusory labels. They're terms that reach a conclusion rather than being descriptive. So that's fine for your editorial pages. It is not what you do in your news coverage.
Although for years, and we discussed it on this program, how we would be loath to use the word liar to describe somebody, and now that's become the mainstream because Trump has pushed it.
We describe
that.
Lies as lies. Yeah. We have to say that. Yeah. We are out of time on that point, and you know, some more of these issues we will take up in future shows. So anyway, we're grateful to the New Visions Law and Government classes for joining us here at the WAMC studios. To Ira Fussfeld, Alan Shartok, I'm Rex Smith. Thanks for joining us this week on The Media Project.
It must have startled poor old Sadie's on ting-a-ling-a-ling city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspaperman meets
the Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok is CEO of WAMC, professor emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. And Ira Fussfeld is the publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org, or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now publishers are such interesting people.
Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.